Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. This is the last day of another broadcast week. You can call in if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. We'll talk about your questions. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to talk about that, well, we'll talk about that too if you call in. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, our first caller today, it looks like our lines may be full, so if you get a busy signal, call in a few minutes, and hopefully you'll get through. Our first caller is Andy from Buckeye, Arizona. Hi, Andy. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in and bring up Ephesians 4:26. Been meditating on it, and it says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Verse 27, same sentence, says, nor give place to the devil. So I've heard a lot of sermons on this one, and I've never really thought too hard on it, but I wanted to ask you what you thought of the merits of a particular interpretation I'm taking away from this that I haven't heard before. The anger that it seems to be referring to is at the outset, be angry and do not sin is what we might call righteous, just, holy, sinless anger. Kind of like how Jesus, what was on display when Jesus was angry in the temple. We all can remember that one. So if in the same sentence, it says, do not let the sun go down on your anger, it would then depend upon what type of anger we're referring to. So one of my takeaways was potentially, well, don't let the sun go down on your righteous, just, holy, sinless anger. And is that a possibility in your assessment?
I would take it that way. Yeah. I mean, because obviously, well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think what he may be saying is anger is appropriate at times, but frankly, you should get it under control. Even if you're angry at something that's a righteous matter, you shouldn't be living angry. Anger is not supposed to characterize your life. If you don't get it under control before you go to bed, you're neglecting something and it's going to be eaten at you. And, you know, you may even give place to the devil, he says, by doing that. I think that's what he implies when he says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath nor give place to the devil. I think the idea is that the devil gets a foothold in our lives if anger is a major feature of our lives. That doesn't mean we shouldn't ever feel anger. It's like we should, you know, should we ever feel fear? Well, of course we should feel fear. There are times when if we don't feel fear, we'll do stupid things because they're dangerous things. And natural fear causes us to wisely avoid certain dangers. But to live in fear, to let fear dominate you, or to be a characteristic that that people would describe you by, is certainly nothing good. That's being paranoid, in its worst extremes. I think that fear and anger are both emotions that have appropriate moments, but both of them can become obsessions. And I think he's saying don't let it become an obsession, even righteous anger. Even if you're angry because you heard of some great injustice against some innocent party, well, you should feel anger about that. But rather than just staying angry, anger as well as fear, both of these emotions, properly used, motivate to positive action. If you're angry at an injustice, it should motivate you to, you know, act for justice in the situation. If you feel fear about a danger, that should motivate you to check out whether you ought to back away from that danger or not.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously emotions aren't just there to be felt. They're there to motivate. They're there to inspire action.
Is it possible that it could be saying, don't let it cease. Don't let it go down. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, meaning do not let your righteous anger cease.
No, I don't think so. I think the sun going down would be an expression that would refer to the day ending. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I did have one other quick question, and that is, I've been also meditating a lot about how Jesus, when he was on the cross, was praying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Uh-huh.
And despite all my years being a Christian, I could probably count on one hand having prayed something like that for other people, or I'm asking God to, you know, from that place, from that type of a heart, asking God to forgive someone else with almost without condition. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what your take was on the application of the model that Jesus gave, because in my heart, I feel I don't want God to forgive them. I expect that God will avenge. You know, vengeance is God, and he's a just God, and he will bring justice to them. I'm going to love them. I'm going to release them. That's out of my hands. I'm giving them over to God to deal with, but I'm counting on him being a just God and dealing with it however he sees fit. So I'm trying to reconcile that.
Yeah, well, remember, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. If somebody doesn't know what they're doing, it'd be rather cruel to hope that they would be punished to the extent that their actions would otherwise deserve if they did know what they were doing. I mean, people often do very foolish things just because they're clueless. And that's, now, of course, who was he praying for? Was he praying for the Jews? Was he praying for the Romans? They were the ones crucifying him, and they didn't have a clue what they were doing. You know, they were just, carrying out orders. Their regular daily job was to crucify criminals that were handed over to them by the courts. They were the executioners of the nation, and here's a criminal, as far as they knew, who was handed over to them to be crucified. So they did their job, but they didn't know who he was or what it was. So it's, you know, the Bible says that he said this when the Romans were crucifying him. So it may be that we're to understand, Father, forgive them refers to forgive these Romans. Romans. They don't have a clue what's going on here.
And that he didn't, orders.
That he didn't hold it against them. Now there's another possibility. Of course, we know that the New Testament, generally speaking, places the burden of responsibility for the crucifixion of Christ on the Jewish leaders and their rejection of him. And we know that because Paul and others in the New Testament say that it was the Jews who crucified Christ. Peter said that on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, and Paul said it in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. I think it's around verse 14 or so. Paul said that the Jews crucified Christ. Now, the Jews didn't nail any nails in his hands because that was a Roman method of execution, but the Jews did engineer it. They did falsely accuse him before Pilate so that he could get crucified. It was done at their instigation. And so they were the ones who really were in need of forgiveness. And it's possible that Jesus meant that about the Jews, because there were Jews and others standing there hurling insults at him, saying, you know, if you're the Christ, come down from the cross, and mocking him and so forth. He might have had them in mind too. And if so, it might be this, that not so much that he's saying, you know, I absolve them of all sin, you know, let them directly go to heaven when they die, you know, that kind of forgiveness. So we often think of that, but it may well be that God was poised to destroy the Jewish nation right then and there if Christ hadn't interceded for them. As a high priest intercedes for the nation, his intercession might have spared that generation so that the destruction that came upon them was delayed for 40 years to another generation. I don't know. It's not real clear, but it does seem in the context of his statement that he may be speaking about the Romans, where he says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
So as far as an application to be Christ-like,
you should always desire that God would go easy on your enemies, I think. And of course, God will do what he has to do. It is true that we expect God to avenge wrongs against us if we do not avenge ourselves. The Bible says that. But that doesn't mean that we wish the worst upon them that they deserve. We certainly hope that we get better than what we deserve in the judgment. And if we love our neighbors, we love ourselves. And if we love our enemies, then we would certainly hope that they get less than what they deserve. But we leave it in the hands of God. We do pray for them. Now, Jesus, in praying for them, like I said, it might have been like a high priestly official prayer absolving them of this particular action, which might have brought immediate judgment upon them from God had he not prayed for them. I don't know. But in general, we need to have when Jesus said, bless those who curse you and do good to those who abuse you, he doesn't mean just so that you'll be doing them greater harm by putting it on God's shoulders to judge them, and he'll do it. Yeah, he will. I mean, we have the confidence that if we don't avenge ourselves, that doesn't mean that justice will never be done. God will take care of things according to his means. But just as I desire God to forgive me and not bring every judgment upon me that I deserve for my actions, I should desire that for others, including those whom I've been injured by.
Right. Well, thanks for taking my call. We're praying
for the
Narrow Path Ministry. Thank you.
All right. God bless you. It's good talking to you again. All right. Our next caller is Jeffrey from San Francisco. Jeffrey, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Oops. Let me see. I thought I didn't activate.
Not a Christian.
Hello? I didn't activate your phone when I thought I did, so I missed the first part. Go ahead and start over.
I just want to say Donald Trump is not a Christian. The gospel is written in the stars, and the Shroud of Turin truly depicts the image of the God-man Jesus Christ.
What is the reason for your call?
I want to make a call and a comment. Those were my comments, and my call is wish you a Happy New Year.
Now the problem with it is you made certain statements, but you didn't give any particular defense of them or evidence for them. So you made some statements that are not universally recognized by the audience or by myself even sometimes. And what I would expect, when I say if you want to call to disagree with the host, do. What I mean is call up and disagree, but make a case. You know, make a case for your point rather than just saying, hey, I disagree about this. Bye. You know, that's not what I mean. I'd like to have a dialogue about this. You said that Donald Trump is not a Christian. Now, I've never said that he was, and I don't have any knowledge of whether he is or not. But you have reason to say that. It's not a very charitable thing to say about him. So I just wonder, do you have some evidence on this matter?
Sure. Okay. Because this is important. You know, he's the president of the United States, the most powerful person in the world. And he claims to be a Christian, a man of who follows Christ. He's not humble, so that automatically disqualifies him from being a Christian. Humility is an absolute in Christianity. You don't have any bragging rights, so that disqualifies him from there. He insults people. He has a record of prostitutes. He's done business with the mafia. He's just an arrogant person who just understands how to live as an elitist. I don't hate him. I do agree with him on some issues, but in terms of Christianity, if you're a Christian, you need to have a Christian-like character to represent Christianity, represent Christ, and he doesn't have that. He's just like the opposite. He's arrogant in power. He doesn't understand, and if you know some of his history, he went to church, and one of his heroes of the faith, if you want to call it, was, I think, Dr. Vincent Price or Dr. Vincent Peale. You know, the person who's written those books?
Norman Vincent Peale, yeah. The positive.
Right, right,
power,
yeah.
Positive thinking.
Right. Yeah, he was kind of like the Joel Osteen of his day, you know? He was all into powerful thinking, think positive, doesn't get into doctrine.
You're right. But let me just share with you where I agree with you and where I might not agree with you. I agree with you that Christians have no bragging rights and every Christian should be very humble. I also believe that Christians should not be taken up with watered down gospels like the power of positive thinking, things like that. So, I mean, insofar as Trump may be guilty of any of that, I agree that he's not behaving as an ideal Christian would. I also know that there's many people who I think are true Christians who really struggle with areas of humility and pride or are deceived by certain things. So I'm not really... I wouldn't say, for example, now, like you believe in astrology somewhat, and you've mentioned that before. I don't put any stock in astrology, and I don't think the Bible supports astrology, but I wouldn't say you're not a Christian because we disagree about that. I'd say that that's an area where you hold one opinion and I hold another, And I think you're mistaken, but you can be mistaken and still be a Christian. I'm not going to judge whether you're a Christian or not for that. Likewise, I won't judge whether a person is a Christian or not by whether they enjoy watching Joel Osteen, although I don't like his ministry very much. But, you know, I mean, Christians can watch lots of different people and like different kinds of books, but not all Christians are very well educated as Christians, and some of them are quite mistaken about certain subjects. As far as Trump's moral life, you know, frankly, I think Mr. Trump has been more out upfront about his immoral behavior than any of our previous immoral presidents have been. I don't know that President Clinton was ever as outright plain spoken about his immoral behavior as Trump has been. But the difference is that the allegation, or the what is alleged, from what I understand, is that Mr. Trump, it is claimed, the gossip is that he became a Christian during the campaign. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but if it did, then it has no, then whether he's a Christian or not has no bearing on what he did before that point. So many people, like the prodigal son, have done some very horrible things in their lives and then become Christians. I don't know of any immorality in Mr. Trump's life that's taken place since his alleged conversion. And so I can't say whether he's a Christian. I don't know if he is or not. But for someone to say he isn't, I just wonder how someone would have the knowledge of that. True, he's not very humble. And true, he's, you know, he's got a lot of mannerisms that are very un-Christ-like. But so I have to say, in my earlier Christian life, I've certainly been too proud, and I've been too unlike Christ as well. But the question is not whether you're entirely like Christ as a Christian, but whether it's your desire to be like Christ, whether it's you've kind of made it an aim to follow Christ. I don't know whether Mr. Trump has made that aim or not, but if he did, and if it happened when he was upwards of 70 years old, he'd have a lot of changes in behavior and attitudes and so forth to relearn. And I don't know if he's had very much time to do that. So I'm going to leave the judgment of whether he's a Christian as an open question at this point. I guess I'm interested in seeing what he does in the years after his alleged conversion. That'll tell me more than anything he did before his conversion. Hey, I'm going to have to take another call, but I appreciate you sharing with us. Our next caller is Brian from Austin, Texas. Brian, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Brother Steve. Happy Friday to you.
Thank you.
Over the Christmas break, I read your book on hell, and I enjoyed it. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you.
My question doesn't have to do with that, but it's a pretty simple question. I'll take it off the air because I'm driving and using Bluetooth, so it's probably not the clearest of call. But in Revelation 14 and 12 and Revelation 12 and 17, it talks about, I imagine believers, but it calls them those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. What specific commandments is John referring to right there? Thank you. Have a good Friday, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Brian, for calling. Well, you know, Jesus said, and by the way, this is recorded in the Gospel of John, who also wrote the book of Revelation. So we shouldn't be surprised if the author of Revelation uses some of the same language that we find in the other books by the same author. But in John chapter 14, Jesus is recorded as saying, if you love me, keep my commandments. And in 1 John, it says, he that says that he knows God and does not keep his commandments is a liar. So we've got, not only in Revelation, but also in John's Gospel and in 1 John chapter 2, affirmations that being a Christian involves keeping Christ's commandments. Now, also in John chapter 13 and verse 34, Jesus said, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. And he said, this is how all men will know you're my disciples, if you have love one for another, which is, of course, keeping his commandment. And that is also affirmed in 1 John. So John's other writings, you know, in Revelation, he describes Christians as those who keep the commandments of God and who have the testimony of Jesus. Having the testimony of Jesus simply is saying that they have and embrace the gospel, and that they keep the commandments of God means that they're obedient to the gospel. And obedience would mean they're doing what Jesus said to do. Remember, Jesus said, again in John chapter 8 and verse 31, if you continue in my words, then you are my disciples indeed. So those who continue to follow Jesus and his words, his teachings, his commandments, those who have adopted as the rule of their life the teachings of Jesus would be the ones that are true disciples, according to Jesus. You are my disciples indeed if you continue in my words. So in Revelation, it's very much in keeping with the rest of John's other writings to identify Christians as those who are keeping Christ's word, keeping his commands. And they are the commandments of God, because Jesus has all authority in heaven and earth from God to give those commandments. So it's like, Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, if anyone thinks himself to be spiritual or a prophet, let him acknowledge that the things I write unto you are the commandments of the Lord. Now, he means the commandments of Jesus. But what he's saying is, I have been authorized by Jesus to give instructions. So my commands are to be taken as the commandments of Jesus. Jesus can say, I've been authorized by my Father to give commands. So my commandments are the commandments of God. And we see that connection when Jesus says to the disciples, whoever receives him that I send receives me, just as whoever receives me receives the Father who sent me. That is, and he later said in John chapter 21, he said, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. So the idea here is that the Father sent Jesus as his agent. Jesus sent the disciples, the apostles, as his agents. And so that whatever Jesus teaches as an agent of God is a command from God. Whatever the apostles taught as agents of Christ are commandments of Christ. And so for John to speak of the teachings of Christ, the words of Christ that define discipleship as the commandments of God, is a very normal thing, not only in the book of Revelation, but also in John's other writings, especially in the Gospel of John and in the first epistle of John. All right. Let's talk next to Lou from Los Angeles. Hey, Lou. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Hi.
Okay, thank you. In the first couple of chapters of Genesis, it states that the sons of God came down to the earth and had relations with women. And my question on this is, I thought there was only one son of God, Jesus Christ, and why would these beings come down and want relations with human beings?
Yeah, well, good question. Actually, the passage you're referring to is in Genesis 6, the opening verses of Genesis 6. It does not say, as you said, the sons of God came down. It does not say that they were up and needed to come down. It just says the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful to look upon, and they took wives of them as many as they chose. So it talks about sons of God seeing daughters of men. There are many who believe that the sons of God refers to angels, fallen angels in this case, who were in fact in heaven. So for, as you paraphrase it, they came down and married women would be appropriate if that is true. But it doesn't say they were angels. The term sons of God, or the word son of God, just in general, are used several different ways in Scripture. For example, God said to Pharaoh that Israel, the nation, was his firstborn son. And that if Pharaoh did not release Israel, then God would punish Pharaoh by taking his son from him. So Israel collectively is God's son. The Israelites individually could be seen as sons of God, especially the godly ones. Godly people in the New Testament are called sons of God, too. In John chapter 1 and verse 12, as many as received him, to them he gave the power to become sons of God. In 1 John chapter 3, it says, beloved, now we are the sons of God. Angels are apparently called sons of God in Job chapters 1 and 2. And so we have various people called sons of God, but not all in the same sense. Jesus, when the Bible refers to Jesus as the Son of God, it sometimes uses the Greek word monogenes, which means unique. In fact, in the most famous verse in the Bible, John 3:16, where it says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. The word only begotten in the Greek is really monogenes, which doesn't mean only begotten. That's an old-fashioned translation that Greek scholars know is not accurate. Monogenes means unique, one and only. So Jesus is the one and only unique son, unlike any other. There are others who are called sons of God in different respects. The rulers of Israel in Psalm 82 are called sons of the Most High. The nation itself is called God's son. Godly people are called God's sons. In Genesis 6, I don't see why angels would be interested in human women, but I believe that sons of God could, in that place, refer to godly men, which is not an unusual use of that term. So if the sons of God means godly men, and they saw the daughters of Adam, which would be the daughters of Adam who were not children of God, who were not godly people, and married them, that would mean there'd be interfaith marriage, which broke down the integrity of the godly line that had existed before the flood. At least that's one way of seeing it, and that is the way I lean toward. So I wouldn't adopt the idea necessarily that the sons of God were angels or that they came down and married women. It's a very popular view. It was held by many of the Jewish rabbis before Jesus' time. It was held by some of the church fathers. And it's held by many Christians today, but it's not necessarily what the Bible says, and it's not, in my opinion, what the Bible means when it speaks. We're going to take a break and come back. We have another half hour ahead of us, so don't go away. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from our website, but there's lots of resources at our website, and they're all free. You don't have to donate, but you can take what's there, or donate, or both. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Stay tuned for 30 seconds. We'll be right back.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you want to bring up questions about the Bible or disagreements you may have with the host, we'll talk about it. The number to call is 844-484-5737 if you'd like to join us on the program. Valerie from Sherwood, Oregon, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yes, hi. I'm so glad I got in today.
Yes.
I have a question about, well, it's about the demonic, excuse me, I was talking to a woman last night who said she was attacked by the demonic because she prayed for somebody out of her jurisdiction according to the courts of heaven, and the demons told her that the person she was praying for had a right to this, whoever it was, and that she could pray for him for smaller things, but not the main thing. And I've not heard about this praying outside of our jurisdiction according to the courts of heaven.
Yeah, well, the reason you haven't heard about it is it's not in the Bible, and I've never really heard any Christians who held that view before. Now, I've encountered Christians who had all kinds of superstitions about the demonic, and I do mm-hmm. believe in the demonic. I believe in demons.
Oh, yeah.
I believe in demon possession. I believe, you know, that right. there's a demonic realm, and that we are waging war with it. But I've never. I've even heard people talk about territorial spirits, and there is some limited biblical background for that possibility of there being mm-hmm. demons over certain territories. But the idea that you can't pray for someone outside your jurisdiction, what jurisdiction yeah. is that? You know, we're praying in the name of Christ. Christ is above all authority and all power and jurisdictions. And when we pray in the name of Christ, we are, as it were, taking on the identity of Christ. He has allowed us to do that because we are his flesh and his bones. We're his body. And so we are enabled to stand, as it were, in the position of Christ and to pray. That's what it means to do something in someone's name. If you have a lawyer who signs papers in your name, they're standing in your position with your authorization, acting on your behalf as though he's you or she's you. And that's what it means to pray in the name of Christ. It means we stand in his place, with his authorization, praying on his behalf. Now, his place is above all rulers. All authority in heaven and earth belongs to him, so there's really no jurisdiction outside of his. And if you're praying other than in Christ's place, then you might as well save your breath, because the only prayers God has, you know, promised to answer are those that are in the name of Christ. And if they're in the name of Christ, there's no jurisdictional limitations.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, I think she's kind of superstitious about something. I'm not sure where she's getting the idea. Maybe someone taught her that, or maybe she felt like a demon, or someone told her that, or God told her that.
Well, there is a book out teaching something like that, but I don't know the name of it. So maybe she wrote that or read that book.
Yeah, that's possible. That is possible. All right.
Well, thank you.
Okay, Valerie. God bless you. Thank you for calling. Let's talk to Thomas from Las Vegas, Nevada. Thomas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thank you. Thomas. There's no sound coming from Thomas. Okay, so sorry, Thomas, if you want to call back, I'll be glad to talk to you. Let's talk to Chris from Portland, Oregon. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thank you for everything you do. I really appreciate your ministry. And I had a quick question, and I don't know if you're even interested in talking about it, but I think it's a really kind of a fascinating topic that doesn't really get covered enough. And it's just the whole founding of, you know, Islam with this, what happened with Muhammad in the cave and the visit from the angel Gabriel. I mean, it just really blows my mind that we've got, you know, such a following of this religion at this point, when it really flies in the face of followers of Christ. And I don't know.
Well, yeah, and it couldn't. Yeah, it would not be possible for Islam to make the gains it does in places like Europe, where it's growing very rapidly. I mean, apart from just their birth rate. I mean, they do, the Muslim immigrants into Europe have a much higher birth rate than the, you know, the long-term people who've been in Europe for centuries. And therefore, Islam is growing that way. But in terms of converts, and they do have quite a few converts, that could never have happened unless the influence of Christianity had diminished. Because, you know, there's a saying that if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And you'd think that people who give up on Christ and don't stand for him, that they'd be cautious. If they don't believe in Christ, that they wouldn't quickly believe in any other religion. But, you know, when you give up the common sense that is in the Christian religion, the Christian worldview, then nonsense becomes much more reasonable to you. And I think that that's what's happened, where there's a vacuum of Christianity's receding. Islam has rushed in. And part of that is because for a while there, the receding of Christian influence in Europe and America was being filled not by religion at all, but by secularism, by humanism and by atheism and just secularism in general. And so there was an attempt, apparently, on the part of some in the culture to get rid of religious sentiments and religious beliefs from people and just have them be, you know, look to science and look to nature and look to secular rulers and teachers and so forth to give meaning to life, but it doesn't. Secularism can't give any meaning to life. And people, you know, when they don't have any religion, there's a vacuum there that is looking for something that is transcendent, something that, you know, gives purpose to life. Because frankly, if you're just secular and you just believe we evolved from animals, well, there's no real purpose for an animal existing except to be part of the food chain, really. I mean, what is the purpose for a gazelle's existence? Well, it's probably there to feed a cheetah, you know, and much as we might find that distasteful, what other reason does it have for living? There is no purpose. There's no transcendent purpose in life unless God made things for a purpose. And if he didn't make us in his own image, then we just evolved from animals, so we don't have any more purpose than an animal has. And that's, you know, that's very, not only is it unsatisfying, it doesn't fit the facts. And so people are looking for some connection with, you know, a transcendent, eternal, meaningful, purposeful being. And if they've already ruled out Christianity because they don't like it for some reason, well, there's another religion standing by ready to rush in and fill that void. And that happens to be Islam. The thing is, though, the claims of Islam are so much less credible than those of Christianity, because Christianity is based on historical facts of Christ's life and death and resurrection, the nature of which, with his miracles and his resurrection and so forth, prove him to be the Son of God, which he claimed to be. Islam doesn't have anything like that. They have a man who he certainly didn't claim to be the Son of God. He claimed to be a prophet, but he never proved himself to be a prophet. There's nothing in his life that would prove that the angel Gabriel appeared to him or gave him the Quran or anything like that. That's just an unverifiable claim. But the claims about Jesus Christ are verified not only from eyewitness accounts in the Gospels, but also from secular accounts, from Jewish and Roman historians. And so, you know, why go with a belief that has no evidence for it in history, and reject a belief that has tons of evidence for it? This is something that I think most people are just so ignorant. They don't know. You know, Sam Harris, who wrote a book, more than one book, but he wrote a book called Letter to a Christian Nation. He said, do you Christians, he's writing to Christians, he says, does it give you any difficulty sleeping at night to know that the Muslim has as much reason to believe in his faith as you have to believe in yours? And I thought, well, that one isn't hit me very directly, because the Muslim doesn't have the same basis for his belief as I have for mine. Now, there may be many Christians who have no idea what the basis of their faith is. They were only raised to be Christians and they don't know why. In that case, the Muslim has as much reason to believe in Islam as that Christian has to believe in Christianity. But that's not true of anyone who looks into evidence. You can look at the history of Islam and at the history of Christianity, and suddenly the basis is miles apart, because Christianity is a historically verifiable faith. Islam, well, the history of Muhammad is abominable. I mean, the guy was definitely a womanizer in the extreme and bloodthirsty, and he killed lots of people, mostly Jews, and took their wives. And, you know, he had the wives watch him kill their husbands, and then he slept with them. I mean, this is a wonderful religious leader, right? And that information is not from anti-Muslim propaganda. That comes from the Muslims' official histories of the life of Muhammad. They're not ashamed of that. I am. I would be if I was a Muslim.
What's your thoughts on bowing, how everybody has to bow and face the Kaaba, too? Isn't that idolatry at its finest?
Well, it is probably idolatry. I don't know if there's an image that they are worshiping per se, because, you know, I think they're venerating. Sort of like when Roman Catholics venerate Mary. They say, well, we're not worshiping her, we're venerating her. Well, I'm not sure what the difference is. If you bow down and venerate somebody, or if you bow down and worship them, what's the difference? I don't really know what the difference is. But the biggest problem I have with Islam is it's just a pagan religion that is not true. And Christianity is a religion that is demonstrably true from historic fact. Unfortunately, though,
gotcha.
Sam Harris is right in the case of many Christians. Many of them don't have, or I should say they don't know that they have a better basis for believing in Christianity than the Muslims have. And Christians who don't go to the trouble of discovering that are, you know, vulnerable to being led astray. And that's what's happened in Europe. That's what's happening in America to a large extent.
Well, it seems like the people that are in charge of this world are really all about the secular that you kind of touched on earlier. And I think that's why the whole open, everyone can just believe whatever they want to believe, because, you know, according to the people that run things, nothing really matters. You're all just animals anyways. So, you know.
All right.
Pretty fascinating stuff. But thank you for everything you do, Steve, and have a wonderful day. God bless.
Okay, Chris, thank you for your call. Good talking to you. All right, our next caller is John from Newport Beach, California. John, thanks for waiting. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question for you. I'm trying to disseminate a good church to go to. I, on one hand, am not really a fan of Catholicism, and I won't go into details on that. On the other hand, I'm not very happy with a lot of the non-denominational churches with their overemphasis on certain topics that I don't really think the Bible gives merit to. So I was looking at the Reformed Church. I like a lot of what they have to say. I like their stances doctrinally, but I found that I'm not really on board with some of the overemphasis that they put on things such as the recital of creeds and almost, I guess I just, you know, just an overemphasis on communion itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get your take on that. Is that something that, I mean, do you think holds merit that you would have to do every week? And is that really a healthy thing for the walk of a Christian to simply stand up, sit down, and memorize where there's not a lot of relational emphasis there?
Well, I do have my differences. I do have my differences with Reformed churches. First of all, I'm not a Calvinist, and they are. Also, they do hold some views about the communion that I don't hold. They don't hold quite the same views that the Catholics hold, but Lutherans and Presbyterians both hold a view, and so do Episcopalians, of communion, that it's more than just a symbolic memorial. And I believe that the Bible teaches that it was a symbolic memorial, just like Passover was a symbolic memorial of the Exodus from Egypt. Jesus said, now when you do this Passover ritual, you do it to remember me. So as it was a memorial of the deliverance from Egypt originally, Jesus changed it into being a memorial about what he's doing for us. But that's, he never indicated it's more than that. There's no suggestion in the Bible that it's more than that. And so I think that, you know, there are some superstitions about that that crept into the church early on to make there be a certain amount of magic associated with this communion that the Bible doesn't hint at anywhere. As far as recommending a church, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of churches, and some people really like this stand up and sit down and recite the creeds and things like that. And those are not things I consider to be evil or heretical. I mean, lots of churches have their own liturgies. I like a church that's a little less liturgical myself, but what I like isn't necessarily what you have to like. Now, apparently you're not really into the liturgical church either, from what I hear you saying. So I don't know what to recommend. I will say that there are churches that are pretty balanced in their teaching, but most denominations have their favorite doctrines that they're going to emphasize somewhat, maybe excessively sometimes. I really can't tell you. What I can say is that you should visit churches until you find one that does, you know, provide what you're looking for. And it's a shame that someone would have to say that. It's a shame that we'd have to say, you know, I have no idea what church is going to be any good in your area. But, you know, here's the thing. I could say, well, I know of a really good Baptist church over here in this town that I kind of like, but I don't know if the Baptist church in where you live is going to be any good, because churches are good or not good based on internal factors. What is the attitude of the leadership? What kind of preaching is there? What kind of people are there? Is it a community of loving people or not? I mean, those are the things that make a church a good church. And, you know, you can't say that any one denomination has the corner on the market of those features. In a denomination that has some really good preachers, they may have some individual churches that have really poor preachers. In a denomination that has some really loving people, in some congregations, you may find congregations where they're a bunch of prigs and they're not very loving. You just can't really say. So what you have to do is you have to have boots on the ground, man. You need to go and visit some of them. And, you know, if you go into a church, you need to be generous in your judgment of them, because you're not perfect and they're not perfect and Christians aren't perfect. But you should have certain things you're looking for. And one should be that the preaching is biblical, and the people see themselves as a loving community. Those are the main things. And the leaders are not, you know, don't see themselves as bosses, but see themselves as servants. Those are the things that I think are the main features that make a good church. And as far as which one you pick, that'll have to depend on your taste and your experience and what you find as you do your own explorations. All right, let's talk to Tony from Rochester, New York. Tony, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I got a question about the annihilationist view.
Uh-huh.
I'm having trouble seeing the purpose of punishing someone and then removing them from existence.
Yeah.
They won't be around to have any, corrective benefits from that. Is that just to settle some cosmic balance for God's sake, or some gift to us that we see people get what they deserve? Or it almost makes sense to just remove them from existence and skip the
punishment.
The short-term punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is definitely one of the weaknesses of the annihilationist view that is brought up by its critics. And I have to say it's a sensible one. That doesn't mean I reject the annihilationist view. I don't know if I reject it or not. I'm not sure which view has the most biblical support, but each view has some support and each view has some weaknesses. And I would say that that would be one of the weaknesses of the annihilationist view, that if God's going to just annihilate them anyway, what good is done by punishing them for a period of time after death and then annihilating them? Why not just snuff them? And you raise some options as possible explanations. You know, they're in the whole system of cosmic justice, it'd be an awful thing, that it'd be an injustice if people who were oppressors and cruel and hurtful to all other people during their whole life, and they didn't, and they died comfortably in their sleep, if they were simply annihilated and there is no punishment for what they did, except that they miss out on going to heaven. Well, missing out on going to heaven would certainly be a serious penalty. But the thing is,
they wouldn't be there to regret it.
They wouldn't be there to regret it, so they wouldn't know that they're suffering. Yeah. And so some people feel that it's like someone going to jail. You know, if somebody has committed crimes, turning them over to the firing squad in every case wouldn't be that satisfying, because they wouldn't know, they'd immediately die and wouldn't ever have to face their crimes and wouldn't ever have to have any regrets for their crimes or whatever. But I can't answer you on that, because there's not an answer that all persons of that camp would feel comfortable with. Some would say the fact that we want them to suffer something for their evil deeds is just an unwarranted vindictiveness on our part. And that, the fact that they don't get to share eternity with God is punishment enough, whether they know it or not. The fact that they don't know it doesn't mean that they're not missing out. They're missing out. They're just not aware of it. So that is a question that is often raised and a difficult one to know how to answer. It'd be even, to my mind, it's even harder to answer, why would God have a hell of eternal torment, though? What is the point of that? So they regret what they're doing, but they can't be redeemed from it. They can't change from it. It never ends, so there's never any settling score. The score is never settled, because if the score was settled, it would end. The fact that it doesn't end means the score is never settled. So in the eternal torment view, God never ends the problem of sin. It's always got unfinished business associated with it. So, from those considerations, many people have felt that the universal reconciliation view has merit, because that at least does have a purpose. And even if people in hell suffer in such a way, though, that they're able to repent and come to God, then no one would have to ask any question why there's value in that.
Yeah, my beliefs are very similar to yours. I'm undecided, but I've become unconvinced of the traditional view. But the point that I raised is probably the main thing that keeps me from landing in the annihilationist camp, I guess.
Yeah, well, I do know, I know some annihilationists. For example, there's a website called Rethinking Hell. It's actually a Facebook page called Rethinking Hell. And it's run... Yeah, right. And so one of the leaders at that group has told me that he's annihilationist. The whole site is largely annihilationist. But he said he's one of those who believes that once the sinner has died, there is no more punishment. They're just annihilated. And there isn't a period of punishment afterwards, because that would be useless. And that view agrees with the Jehovah's Witness view, whereas the view that sinners in hell suffer for a while as much as they deserve to, and then they're annihilated, that's more agreeable with the Seventh-day Adventist view. And I'm not saying that either of them is wrong because of those associations. I'm just saying that those views have been around, both those angles have been around for a long time in other groups outside the mainstream evangelical.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for your thoughts and for your time. I think I'm going to go read your book a couple more times.
Okay, Tony. Great. I think it's always good to read at least twice.
Yeah.
God bless you, brother.
Thank you.
Bye now. All right. We're almost out of time here. Let's see who's been here longest. Kirby from San Diego is next. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Kirby.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I had a question. A neighbor of mine told me, I live in San Diego, California, and I was referring to the Rock Church, and they said that Miles McPherson, when he first started, anyway, he was sent to a jail to witness to a cop killer.
Not a cop.
Oh, it doesn't make sense. A cop killer. And so my question was, why would you go and speak, I mean, can a cop, if you kill someone, is there any way, I mean, I thought if you kill someone, there's no way you'd get redemption.
Really?
Is that right?
Well, no. I mean, no, God can forgive all sin. David killed the husband of Bathsheba, Uriah, and he was forgiven. And if forgiveness can be found in the Old Testament, it can certainly be found in the New.
Okay, so you're saying that, let's say if, this is very confusing to me. I'm saying, let's say Jeffrey Dahmer, before he was killed in prison, if he found Jesus, you're telling me he could go to heaven? Somebody that was that sick on this planet could actually be taken in God's hand? That's hard for me to comprehend.
Yeah, it is hard to comprehend. In fact, there is a rumor that he did find Jesus before he died, Jeffrey Dahmer. But I guess the question is, do we think that God should forgive us of the sins we've committed? We might say, well, I'm not such a pervert as that. Well, in my opinion, I'm not such a pervert as that. But by God's standards, how far am I above Jeffrey Dahmer? You know, if you have a jumping contest and your opponent is 3 years old, and you say, let's see how high we can jump, and the three-year-old can only jump, you know, 3 inches off the ground, and you can jump 3 feet off the ground, well, you're way ahead of them. But if the goal is to jump to the moon, neither of you have gotten anywhere close. You know, if the standard is, we're going to try to jump to the moon, and the three-year-old can jump 3 inches, I can jump 3 feet, we might as well not have even had the contest, because there's not a dime's worth of difference between how far I can jump and a three-year-old can jump if we're trying to jump to the moon. And if the standard of righteousness that God is seeking from people and requiring from people is the standard of his own character, then I might be a lot better person than Jeffrey Dahmer. But both of us may be as far from what God's requiring as the child and I are far from jumping to the moon. So the real question is, do I want God to make up the difference in my deficits by his grace? If so, I can't complain if he does the same for others. In fact, I should be glad that he did, because frankly, to make something good out of something bad is one of the most desirable and greatest achievements, I think. And that's why God making something good out of you or me is a wonderful thing. Anyway, I'm sorry we're out of time, but I appreciate your call. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can write to us if you'd like to help us stay on the air at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Hope you have a wonderful weekend, and let's talk again Monday. God bless you.